Welcome everyone to Bending the Arc. We have a few updates for you before you begin. First of all, we have a new theme song, and it's by a local musician, Jacob Akana, and you can find a link to that song and where to find more of his works in the notes in our archive, jacobakana.com/links. And also, we had a few issues with the mic this time, mainly my mic, so it doesn't affect so much our interviewee, who has so many important things to share from NorCal Resist. Hope you enjoy the show.
Don't you notice, it always goes this, always seems to end in pain. Don't overthink this, it ain't a weakness, to know we're meant for better days.
Is an offering of the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition in partnership with KKRN, Community Supported Radio. I'm your host, Sharon Brizalera, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Giselle Garcia, who's a volunteer coordinator with NorCal Resist, and we're going to learn about the many things that they do and the volunteer roles within it and how you can get involved. So welcome, Giselle. How are you?
Thank you, Sharon, for having me. I'm doing okay, you know, holding up. How are you doing?
Same. Yeah, it's a challenging time.
It is.
For sure. Well, you know, we begin all of our conversations having people introduce themselves in whatever way they feel is best for centering the conversation.
So my name is Giselle Garcia. I am a daughter of immigrants. I'm first gen here in the United States. I am incredibly passionate about helping our immigrant communities, also our incarcerated population in the United States and right around the world. I have been organizing with NorCal Resist as a volunteer since about late 2018, throughout 2019. And I just have to say, it's an incredible model of what grassroots organizing based on mutual aid and love for your neighbor truly is. And so I'm so honored to be here today and share that work with everyone. We started off as all volunteer, and we were for the first few years. We recently onboarded two staff members, and to say that they do a lot of work is an understatement.
Right.
They do a little bit of everything all the time. But other than that, other than, you know, our incredible two staff navigators, it is all volunteer based.
That's very impressive, especially looking at your website and all the different things that you do.
Yeah, I think NorCal Resist is an organization of action, right? So yes, we absolutely believe that as activists, as organizers, we don't only stand up for certain values in, you know, just vocally, right, against policies, politicians, or institutions that are just perpetuating so much harm. But we should act, right? We should proactively do what we can to begin building the world that we envision, right? So it's trying to build that bridge between theory and practice, right? And so at the root of our work is always do not cause harm, right? Make sure we're very intentional about all of our programming. If we put rallies, right, are we protecting immigrant folks who join us to make sure that they're not at high risk, right? It's about being intentional, making sure that we're benefiting and helping to heal communities that have been marginalized for so long and not harming. And so that you'll just see that our program, it has nothing to do, all of our programs have nothing to do with growing our name, right? Or prestige, or getting funding for countless staff and directors and things like that. No, our two staff, we absolutely need them, and they directly work with all of the folks that need help. So they're always working, and our funds go directly to the people, right? And these programs that help. So I would say, you know, through educational events and training, through actions and maintaining these variety of different resources and programming to meet different needs in the community during a certain time, or just consistently as well over time, that's how we really aim to function as an organization.
Mm-hmm. And I have another question about healing in a second, because that's such an important element and one that not many organizations take fully into account. But first, when you talk about the programs or services or events, can you share with listeners what some of those are? And I know many are of a particular concern to the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition.
Yeah, absolutely. Our programs range from, you know, climate resistance work to labor rights advocacy to immigration rights, immigrant rights advocacy work to anti-incarceration. So it's so much, right? So, for example, we do have a mutual aid farm called Seeds of Solidarity that is 100%, again, it's community run. And what's incredible about this farm is that we're not just, you know, harvesting crops so that we can sell and make profit. No, what we, you know, harvest goes back into the community for free. So whether that be through drop-offs, or we hold, you know, community tables for people to come and pick up produce. And not only that, but it's also very, we strive to harvest culturally appropriate food. So we touch base with our communities that we're helping. What kind of crops would you like to see? What kind of fruits and veggies would you like to see? And if we can grow it in our climate and region, you know, we try to. So it's an incredible project. You know, we try to provide as disaster assistance during the pandemic. We launched our DocuFund. We threw in all of the funding we had for that year. It was when we were very new as an order. We're like, you know what? Every dollar, it's going to the community. At that point, we were 100% organization. So I think we had like $30,000 in the budget for the whole year. And I think in a month, we wrote out checks directly for community members who were undocumented because they had no access to public assistance, especially during that time with Trump and the public charge. And so a lot of folks just had no recourses. And so we started, and all of the money was gone, right? Immediately in a month. And then the community came, and through mostly donations, we were able, after about throughout the year and throughout the pandemic, we gave out $1 million in aid for our DocuFund. We have our community fix-it program. So we respond to our neighbors' requests for minor repairs and maintenance. That's sort of tied in with our brake light repair clinic. And I know it might seem like it's, you know, sometimes we advertise it just for immigrants, but no, it's really advertised for everyone. Everyone in the community can come in. And the idea is because we want to avoid everyone in the community from having unnecessary interactions with law enforcement, because things can escalate, right, for anybody. Mm-hmm. And especially we know also that there are, you know, minorities who are more susceptible to having negative, very negative interactions with law enforcement. So we want to avoid that. We want to avoid those fix-it tickets, those extra costs. We do Know Your Rights trainings. We help. We have our incredible pro se asylum clinic for asylum seekers who, although because we don't have staff, we don't have any attorneys, right, on staff. We don't offer legal representation, but we do help them in preparing that form and meet a very important one-year deadline so that they're not barred from pursuing relief, right? So we're just trying to actively figure out different projects, and we embrace recommendations and do our best to meet needs.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned mutual aid, and some of our listeners are very familiar with a mutual aid approach, and others may not know exactly what that means. What is important to you about a mutual aid approach, and how do you describe it to people who are unfamiliar?
Yeah, no, I think that is such an important question. And I think that also NORCAL Resist's philosophy and approach to mutual aid is at the heart of how we just conduct all of our programming, because it's not even about being a service-based, like, okay, here comes a client and we're servicing them and then here's the next client, right? No, we're truly approaching everyone who comes to us as our neighbors, and trying to assess, you know, their needs from a holistic way, and then coming up with creative ways to meet those needs, or creating community connections with other orgs to see if they can help, right, and plug in. And so mutual aid for us is really about nourishing community relationships by picking up our neighbor when they're down. You know, we can't do everything as much as we wish we could, but we try to do our best. And like I said, we try to connect folks with other organizations if they can, right, help in a space where we might not be able to. So again, it's just this holistic approach to seeing the person, really seeing and empathizing with the struggle that they're facing in that moment, and doing our best to support them through a hard moment. And sometimes it's just emotional. You know, I think our accompaniment training is a program is a huge example of that, where it's right now there's a lot of fear, right, regarding immigration enforcement. And so sometimes, you know, someone wants a friend or someone they can trust to go with them to a doctor's appointment because they're afraid that they might not come back home, right? And so we provide that. And it's incredible, right? We're growing community in real time by doing that. So yeah, that I think that's what how we really just, it's foundational to our work.
What have you learned about what it takes to be part of the healing process for communities? What does that look like for a community to be engaged in healing?
That's a big question.
I know.
And I think just even on a personal level, I think healing is a battle for everyone. And it's so personal in terms of how healing looks different for everyone, right? Sure. And it takes us all, I think for the most part, a long time to figure out how to heal, right? And I think we'll do that forever. We're going to be healing forever in this world, right? But I think being a part of this community of healing means a profound understanding of not what we idealize human experience to be, but what it really is under the current system and the conditions that we are forced to live under, the majority of us. I think it's so symbolic after George Floyd and, you know, the phrase, "I can't breathe," became so an expression of not just police violence, but of how people feel under the system, right? You feel suffocated with very little options, and as someone who grew up, you know, in a poor neighborhood, with a very working class family, I I remember growing up and always feeling like, wow, is this really life? You know, it's not that exciting, right? And kids are feeling this way. I think it's very telling. And so I think healing has to start with that base understanding that most individuals that are system impacted are coming from a position of tremendous emotional, physical, financial strain. And that is not what humans were born to face every day in their life. That is not what our bodies were made for, our minds were made for. And so that amount of suffocation, it's like when you lack oxygen, you know, for so long, you're bound to become lightheaded and make a poor mistake. You're bound to fall. And so I think understanding that kind of helps. I know it helps me navigate when I encounter, you know, a community member who has been struggling so hard. So maybe they're a little bit rougher around the edges. Maybe they're not as trusting with people because they've been let down so many times. To not take things personal, right? So instead of feeling offended because someone might not have the most upbeat personality with me, right? Or maybe they might not accept so openly that I really do want to help them. I shouldn't be upset with them. I need to be upset at the greater system. And that only reinforces my belief in my own responsibility to continue doing the work. It's mm-hmm. not, oh, I have time. Yeah, I'll be able to volunteer an hour a week and feel good about myself. No, I'm obligated to do this work if I want a better world. And because if I love humanity, right, I think it's my obligation. And so that healing work, I know that has helped me become less resentful, not towards people, but just like in general of, you know, or bitter, right? Because I remember early on when I was a young activist, there was a period where I was bitter. You know, it's just like everything is bad. Nothing is ever going to get better. But in this work, as you continue, you do see snippets of hope and light and just love between people. And that just keeps you going. So I think to be a part of this work, you have to see past an individual struggle and really look to them or through them that if maybe they got a little bit of help and things got a little better for them, they could be who they really wanted to be, right? So yeah, I'm sorry. That was a long-winded answer.
It's a great answer. And, you know, part of that is about just recognizing you don't know the whole context and that there is one. But you bring up another important point that I'm finding in the different things that I do and for myself, that it is such a challenging time, emotionally, politically. And there are so many threats to well-being out there and so many things that to be afraid of, particularly if you have been marginalized in a range of ways by income, by race, by status. And I guess my initial question is facing all of that and interacting with people who are feeling the effects of that, what do you and maybe other volunteers do to be able to navigate those challenging emotions, to do your own healing while you're in the process of creating spaces and opportunities for people?
That's a heavy question, right? As you're, you know, I'm thinking of the impacted community members that I've spoken to. I'm thinking of the moments that they've broken down in tears, the fear in their faces, the uncertainty, the stress. And then in those moments when you feel like you feel so small and in control because you can't fix the world for them, as much as you want to in that moment. So I think a lot of us in the movement work, and you often see burnout because it's not just physically taxing, because you're up and adult. What's the next thing to do? What's the next meeting? What have to plan for this? You know, you're constantly moving on top of your 9 to 5, or, you know, and your family obligations in life, right? But it's emotionally heavy work, right? We do try to educate ourselves and inform all of our volunteers on trauma-informed practices when it comes to how we engage with community members, especially when we're doing some really heavy things, like working through someone's asylum application. And they, you know, it is essential to their application that they describe the most horrific parts of their life, right? Persecution, torture, just horrible acts of violence and trauma. And the more detail, right, potentially the stronger their application is. And so when we're navigating that, we want to make sure that we're not adding to that trauma, right? And so we try to make sure that we include trauma-informed approaches in our trainings for volunteers who do help as preparers for that work. But then I think ourselves as volunteers and as, you know, activists, organizers, I think we do tend to forget that we internalize a lot of the pain of the people that we're trying to help. And in one way, I appreciate that I do, because I feel like it keeps my humanity going, as opposed to just embracing desensitization. But I think there has to be a healthy balance too, because it can wear you down, and it might make it so that you walk away from the work. So there has to be a balance. When volunteers feel like they are burnt out anytime, we ask them, please let us know, how can we help you? Can we plan breaks for you? We want to make sure that we are thinking of that and being proactive so we can support volunteers as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Bending the Arc and a conversation with Giselle Garcia from NorCal Resist. You know, one of the things that you mentioned, one of the strategies for remaining engaged and for both educating and acting is that idea of resistance. And how to resist is a skill, and it varies according to the issue in the community and whatnot. What do you see as some of the greatest needs of people in helping to teach them ways of resisting and also ways of advocating?
So I have to say that, I don't think that we rarely hold events where we're teaching, right? We do have our Know Your Rights trainings. We have the trainings for the pro se clinics. They're more technical things, right? But when it comes to, these bigger, more abstract questions of resistance, healing, and strategy and struggle, liberation, I find that these conversations occur within the community spaces that we hold, whether they are a community book reading, or we'll have, recently we were a part of the Anarchist Book Fair, where we had so many incredible local grassroots org who spoke about all the different kinds of work they're doing. We had, how to be a medic training, like an emergency medic, right? Like in a sudden situation. We had, just every range of kind of life work, that can be applicable anywhere was there. And so together we teach each other constantly. It's a conversation. And I, you know, personally find that I learn the most from the people that you might, you know, traditionally less expect, right? So my work with immigrants, I've been working with them for almost a decade now. I've learned so much from them. And I think I don't have to teach them about resilience, right? Mm-hmm. Here they left all they knew behind, more than not to survive, because their life or their children's life was in peril, right, in their home country. And then they come here to a country that does not receive them well, where every step in this country is hard. It's a battle. And the majority of the individuals that I've, you know, been able to, you know, work alongside with, they're not bitter. They still have so much love, and they show it and care. You know, if they they have one plate of food, we all can eat from that plate of food together. You know, there's some for everyone. You learn some of life's most important lessons from the most humble people, and they're the strongest sometimes, you know. I mean, I gotta say. And so I think that's how I think it's this constant cycle of reinforcement of what resilience looks like, right? Because our volunteers come as well, right? They come from all walks of life, right? We have lawyers, we have doctors, we have day laborers, we have people from every industry. We have, you know, people who are homemakers. It's just incredible, the background. So we're just constantly learning from another. And it just feels like without this space and without all of us sharing these values that we're dedicated to seeing a better world, I know there's a lot of folks that I never would have met. I probably never would have had contact with, let alone have the conversations that we're having that help us all grow. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, how we're just, it's like in the process of doing this important, just human work, we become better humans, right? And yeah, so I guess that's how, I mean, it's organic. It just happens so organically.
Well, and you're pointing to that really critical role of being a trusted and safe convener and, you know, ensuring the safety of that gathering and an opportunity for people to share what they know and how they're resilient, how they resist, what resources they have to share and have found in the community.
And it takes a while to build that trust with the community, you know. I started a little after the organization was founded, but when they were first founded, you know, it was a small group of core individuals who believed in something and they got to work. I don't know if they imagined that NorCal Resist was going to be what it is now. You know, it's just incredible. Last night we had our Migra Watch training, which, you know, helps people learn how to identify ICE and know your rights, you know, how to protect yourself. And it was a virtual convening, and we had about 490 people attend.
That's amazing.
I think that small core of five, you know, of less than 10 people, never, I don't think they would have imagined. But it took all of these years, you know, I think it started in 2017 that they founded NorCal Resist. It took all of these years of proving who we are, of consistency, of prioritizing the right things, not listening to the white noise, because there's a lot of things always happening and different orgs take different directions. But NorCal Resist has always understood what it stands for, what it values, and has been consistent. And we have always told our most vulnerable members, immigrants, folks maybe with a record, you know, if you're going to a protest, you know, how do you protect yourself so that you don't, you know, get arrested and end up either in the immigration system or the criminal system, right? That they are a priority, right? We have folks, we've never done anything illegal, right? I want to say that, but given that anyone can get arrested these days, right? Laws aren't always followed. We have people who are prepared to put themselves on the line over our immigrant folks who are especially vulnerable to even more atrocity than just an arrest, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's consistency and just, you don't follow the crowd, you follow those values that matter.
How have you and NorCal Resist, how do you think about your priorities now? Has there been any shifting in terms of what requires more immediate attention in your context of staying true to those? And are there any strategies that you've learned that help you not be diverted by the next challenge?
Yeah. I would, it's funny because so NorCal was founded during the first Trump administration, right? And so a lot of our programming goes that far. So it's not that any of it went away and now we're just bringing it back because, Trump is back, right? No, our Make It Out Watch hotline has still been around for 8 years, right? The Pro Se Asylum Clinic, I think we launched in 2020. It's still going, right? The Break Light Clinics, years, it's still going, right? And so those priorities have always remained understood. And it's also informed by educating ourselves on, again, not just like whatever is sensationalized by the media, but we're going in, we're looking at policies, agency policies, right? We're not just, going down Twitter, the thread and, or what is it called? The news feeds. And that's where we kind of pull,
Watching Jon Stewart.
Trending. Exactly. No, we're looking at concrete issues. We're, monitoring litigation on different issues. We're monitoring local policy, state policy, right? So that's what informs our actions. We're also monitoring what are the growing needs of the community. Sometimes they shift, and so we're trying to match that, but I think right now, for example, the data does show that Trump has not even reached the same average daily averages that the Biden administration did of arresting immigrants and taking them into ICE detention, right? However, the amount of panic that is affecting our communities intentionally, right? Because that is exactly what we know border czar Tom Hellman said, right? That, we encourage you to self-deport, make our jobs easier, essentially. So it's a very intentional strategy. And so what are we doing to combat that, right? Because our community members are calling and saying, I'm so, I heard that ICE is around the corner. I'm so scared to pick up my daughter from school, or I'm so scared to go to work this day, or, it's disrupting their daily lives. They're already living in the shadows, right? And now this added layer of panic can be emotionally crippling for so many people. So how are we responding? We're ramping it up, right? More KY, Know Your Rights trainings, right? We're doing more Migra Watch trainings to expand our network so we can have more responders on the ground. We're holding more pro se asylum clinics if we can. So it's ramping it up. Let's meet those needs, right? But we are also trying to dispel myths, right? We are using those, we are using knowledge and education as a tool of empowerment to kind of bring down the fear. And letting people know, look, this is the data. We've always had ICE in this area. And in fact, right now it is less. We are seeing that maybe it's more targeted now, or, we're letting people know what we are seeing on the ground and whatever shifts. But that's how we respond. We ramp up what we need to ramp up. We're constantly learning from our programs. If there's a mistake or if we feel like we can make an improvement, we're doing it. But we're not going to be distracted by, let's bring back Twitter, right? Or issues that are not directly, you know, impacting our immediate community members that we're doing our best to work alongside and address their needs.
Mm-hmm. So do you have volunteers that, because there's so much executive orders and legislation in process right now, is it your volunteers that are doing that deep dive? Do you have partner organizations like the ACLU or others that help with that? How are you navigating that?
Yeah, so it's both. We do. We collaborate with a lot of other organizations like CCIJ, the California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation, so many wonderful organizations that we maintain each other looped in, but also our volunteers. So as part of my day job, you know, that includes legal research and critical race theory work. And so I plug in when I can, right? Connect those dots. We have folks who do policy work for a living and can engage. We have other folks who, you know, we have lawyers who can, like, you know, deep dive into like legal aspects. So it really is a majority, it's volunteer effort, you know? We're constantly making sure that we come back to NorCal Resist, which is our home base, and use our resources outside of the organization, use our time, use our knowledge, our networks to still serve the needs of our community. But NorCal Resist is kind of like, it, like, you know, it's a place where it sort of incubates everything that we bring in, right? And then it just flourishes into something that can be put into action.
Mm-hmm. You know, so much of what you do overlaps with the SCJC's concerns about equal justice. Mm-hmm. So whether it's the safety and rule of law with people who have status that's in process or undocumented, because that process can take a long time, right? Or people who have been incarcerated, or your brake light program preventing some of those pretextual stops. Are there other things that NorCal Resist is engaged in that you would frame as a matter of equal justice that people might not think about as such?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the core of everything we do, that is exactly, you know, what we're aiming for, right? And our programs are, they're open to everyone in need, right? I mean, maybe the pro se asylum clinic doesn't apply to everyone, because not everyone is going to, you know, like a citizen isn't going to apply for this asylum, right? But our mutual aid farm and the harvest that we, you know, are able to produce, they can go out to anybody, right? We have community tables where people can come and get food, right? We work in collaboration with the Sacramento Food Bank, or, you know, so it's all open to everyone. But I would say that I don't know if I can just point to a specific thing that is about equal justice. I think one of the things that we're so proud of is that anyone can come to us. It is open to everyone, and because we are open to learning from everyone and their experiences, if they come with an amazing idea and are willing to put in the work and run with it, again, we serve as that incubator to help make it happen, right? So we are the safe space, so that if we are, you know, if there's gaps or you see something that is very doable and fits with our mission and values, you have a home to come to, and let's make that happen. And I think in many ways that just allows us to grow what achieving equal justice and mutual aid can look like, should look like. Yeah,
and it seems like that just expands the capacity to meet the unique needs of particular communities where mutual aid or other activities might look different.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's our navigators, you know, our two staff navigators, they're incredible, because I think more than anything, they really cater to more like niche or specialized needs of community members that they're working with. So if a parent comes and they might have a kid with special needs, they will help them navigate on how to get services they need to get at school, right? And they will not just navigate it like, oh, here you go, apply. No, they help them apply. If they say no, they're going to go and advocate. Why did you say no? Absolutely not, right? You know, how to go apply for Medi-Cal or, you know, CalFresh. These things that may seem small, but are really impacting people's day-to-day lives, or maybe helping them get access to things that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Mm-hmm. That navigation role is so critical. I've been involved with a local master plan for aging process, and we had some interviews with the lived experience advisory board to one of our local shelters, and they were just talking about both the process, knowing when things come, the application process, if you don't have your records all in one place. I mean, there are multiple barriers, not having seen an eye doctor for a long time, not being able to, having a hard time actually reading the applications, online processes. So there's so many things.
100%, you know, and when we think of, you know, I always think that, you know, kids and our more senior populations are some of our most vulnerable populations, right? Because they're often neglected, forgotten, or just feel like, oh my gosh, I don't need to take their feelings or experiences into account. I'm focused on myself and they're done. We don't need to pay attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that is incredible work. And I'm so glad to hear that, especially navigating our bureaucratic system is hard for anyone, let alone someone with challenges, either language barriers or mobility issues, eyesight, right? It's very disheartening.
Mm-hmm. With some of the executive orders that have come out, have you heard from any of your partnering organizations, certainly not the ACLU or legal services, but other nonprofits, has there been a reticence to be more publicly supportive of your work or being involved in things for fear of funding cuts or being targeted? Are you seeing any of that?
So I won't speak for any other, you know, community orgs or anything like that or nonprofits. We do know that with the constant threats from the new administration to take away federal funding if people are pursuing programming or services that are not necessarily aligned with the new administration's values or goals. I think a lot of organizations are they're in a period of brainstorming right now, you know, what are the alternatives? How can we replace those federal funds with other forms of funding? So there's a lot of work happening there. And nonprofits, it doesn't matter what kind of areas they focus on, they're all pretty impacted, you know? They're under-resourced, right, underfunded.
Mm-hmm.
They're already struggling. So now having to think about, oh, wow, we might lose a huge part of our funding, it's really going to be taking time away from them. Additionally, there's been threats to nonprofits potentially losing nonprofit status, right? Which is also a threat to how they get funding, right? And how much funding. So I think all of those are tactics to throw nonprofit organizations for a loop,
mm-hmm.
and distract them as well from the important and beautiful work that they're doing. But I do mm-hmm. think that organizations who are committed find a way. It's hard, and I wish it wasn't like that. I'm not saying, you know, it's okay, but I don't think we're going to see nonprofits fall and disappear. I think more than ever, people are ready to fight and figure out novel ways of staying afloat so that we can mm-hmm. keep doing the work.
Mm-hmm. You know, some of the things you do, the brake light repair, other types of engagement, know your rights, you know, MIGRA watch, especially with the stated intention to involve more local law enforcement in some of those deportation efforts. It makes me wonder what kind of interaction or reactions you have gotten from law enforcement. You know, your headquarters is in Sacramento, but you were telling me earlier you work in these other communities. So what has that been like, and how have you either nurtured relationships or set boundaries, or, you know, what does that look like for NorCal Resist?
Ooh, that's a really nuanced question. you know, we go by whatever law enforcement's actions are, right? Not by what they say. We go by what they do, because we do have a lot of eyes on the ground. And we're all so invested in our communities and in monitoring the situation. That is what we're going to base ourselves off always. I'm going to speak for Sacramento, because I mean, if we want to down every county and Ray or like cities on.
Right. That's a docuseries. Yeah. Giselle, we'll talk about that later.
you know, Sacramento, the city of Sacramento, police department did put out a statement saying that they will not be collaborating with ICE under.
They will not be. Okay.
They will not be collaborating with them or giving Sacramento PD resources to ICE for them to carry out their operatives. And so, you know, if that remains the case, and that is what we see, we do absolutely appreciate that. You know, it is California state law as a sanctuary state that localities and, you know, city and county funding for law enforcement and our state law enforcement agency like CHP, or right, those funds, those resources do not go to ICE, right, immigration enforcement, CBP. However, this is not new, right? Law enforcement does what it does in different counties and different cities. And so, for example, in Huntington Beach, they declared themselves a non-sanctuary city. City Council passed that, right? So we don't know what to expect. I think what we do is we trust our community. We trust our organizers, our volunteers, our neighbors, but we do not solely rely on law enforcement or you know, general government officials on what they say, because if it's politically expedient to do something else, that can change. It's a flip of a switch, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're always going to be prepared, and we do not count on law enforcement to protect us. Unfortunately, that's just our position, that we're not going to depend on that. We believe that community keeps one another safe. And that's our, you know, one of our founding principles. And so that's where we're at right now. Unfortunately, I don't think we have any, we haven't had any kind of hostile interactions with law enforcement, right? But we are not collaborating and will not collaborate with law enforcement in any capacity.
Mm-hmm. You're making me think too that looking at what's really happening, the data and the actions, is really important, not relying on the words. And also we find in our county that those words, those statements or threats have an impact as well. And that's been something that's been hard to get across, that you're an elected official, the things that you say have consequences.
Exactly. And our, you know, our Sacramento County Sheriff, Sheriff Cooper, you know, he did say in a statement that he is not going to tell his, you know, deputies, his officers, how to do their job when it comes to ICE enforcement or immigration enforcement, right? So, we can take that for what it is. I don't know, right? We don't know what that means, right, technically. So I think even just being dismissive or sometimes it's better to hear clarity. Yes, we will support ICE. No, we don't plan it, even though we still are always going to, you know, take our own precautions and measures. But sometimes it's better to know who is on your side and who's not. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of, unclear messaging is also very, it can negatively impact the community.
Sure.
Yeah.
How can people find out more about your work and get involved if they choose to?
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely look at our website at norcalresist.org. That's a more broad, layout of who we are and what we do. There's some interest forms that you can fill out there, but you can also just go directly to our social media, NorCalResist on Facebook, on Instagram. On Instagram, we're always disseminating information. I know your rights flyers, if you know anyone that could use them during this time, which everyone can, but if you know anyone specifically, download them onto your phone and hold them, share them with people. So if you do, let's say ICE knocks on your door one day, you just get your phone. I have it here saved. These are my rights, and say them out loud, right? Our updates on events are always there. Our community alerts when ICE is confirmed, when we've confirmed activity through our rapid response team, we alert the community through, our socials to let them know, hey, we've confirmed activity on this street. Just avoid it. Avoid the area if you can, right? So the best way to stay connected is our socials. You can reach out to us via private message through our socials. And like I said, there's a space for everyone in the movement. We have people of all ages, of all backgrounds. So there's space for you.
And the last question, is there anything else that I should have asked you that I didn't, or something that you feel is important to share?
I would say just please, before you trust, media stories that haven't been necessarily, fact check, or before you trust, just off the hinge up. Statements from our own public officials, do your research, or partner with organizations or look to organizations that are doing the real research and trying to find the true facts that then informs their work. NORCA Resist is one of those spaces. You can always reach out to us and look to your community for hope. Don't look at our institutions, don't look at our public officials, look to your community, because everywhere around you, people are doing incredible things that might seem small, but in the aggregate impact our neighborhoods, our communities, and our world in incredible ways.
Thank you so much, Giselle, for speaking with us and for all of the work that you do, and for all of your colleagues at NorCalResist and community members.
Thank you so much, Sharon. You too. Thank you for giving us a platform and so many other important voices in the community a platform.
You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio, speaking with NorCalResist, and check out the archives for all of the links that Giselle shared and for more information.
First person is right, but it ain't the time. Right, but it ain't the time.